This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
So again, you write about so many creative business models, even in this environment. What strikes you right now as an interesting business model? What else is out there that you think is interesting for people to start?
So like we have the hustle and then we have trends. And what trends does is we've hired a team of analysts and all we do is go out and like reverse engineer cool stuff and like do case studies. And we have all these data points to show like what we think is going to be popular. And it's freaking awesome. It's just like my own playground because I like to go out and angel invest in companies and this just tells me what to do. I love it.
And so what trends do you see happening right now? Particularly, it's hard to really predict post-shutdown what's going to flourish and what's going to die in the next 12 months.
It's hard to predict, but I don't think that's the right word that I'm looking for. What I'm looking for is what's possible. And so I like to look at what are consumers or businesses demanding and how are people doing things in other countries or other regions of the world. And basically what's working at a small level already and it's growing, even if it's just growing just a little bit. And then to try to understand, can that be done at a much larger rate? And is there still more room in the marketplace for things similar to that?
So what are people thinking?
Yeah, I mean, it's my belief, and a lot of people don't like hearing this, but wherever there's tragedy, there's gold and opportunity. So I think that for the right-minded person, there's so much opportunity to pounce on right now.
So what else? What's next? I'm just going to keep pounding you for what's next. I have Sam Parr with me. He's the owner of The Hustle Media Company, which has a newsletter with well over a million subscribers. I'm very interested in how you built that, Sam. And also you have The Hustle runs the podcast, My First Million. Another thing that I'm sure everybody's interested in. Everybody wants to make their first million. And you recently had an interesting Twitter thread too about how you created, I guess, like a hot dog food truck. And I'm interested in that, like, because I think I want to get to the Hustle newsletter because I think that's actually understanding the business model of that and how you built up your audience for that, I think is going to be a critical skill set, you know, post this shutdown, lockdown, you know, whatever you want to call it. But I also think, like, in New York City, everyone is saying now, oh, nobody should ever open up a restaurant again in New York. And I do think about 30 to 40% of restaurants in New York City might go out of business. Just, I'm a local business owner in New York City as well. And I know a lot of the restaurant owners and I can just tell you 30 to 40% are done. Doesn't matter about any loans. Doesn't matter about anything. They're done. And so everyone's saying, oh, don't start a restaurant in New York, but it might be the best time to start some sort of food company in New York because everything's going out of business. You're gonna have less competition and still the same population more or less. So, but maybe if you don't want to own a storefront restaurant, a food truck's the way to go.
Yeah, I mean, I know about that. If I was going to be in the food space, and we talked about this for a while, but cloud kitchens are just absolutely the way to go.
Tell me what's a cloud kitchen?
Yeah, so I'll do a small plug, but we own this thing called Trends, which is trends.co. It's like our research arm. And we just research interesting ideas that are growing quickly, and we do case studies on cool companies. I see you typing. Go to trends.co. You can see
it. Yeah, go to trends.co. I'm going to start my $1 trial.
Yeah, it's cool. And we actually just switched over our payment providers like 8 or let's see, it's 9 a.m. like 5 hours ago. So hopefully you don't find any bugs. You might though. But anyway, cloud kitchens are. Like, and I discovered them actually a couple years ago, but if you like would go to Uber Eats, you would see all these restaurants that you had never seen in real life. And they were basically just kitchens without storefronts. And it was interesting for two reasons. The first reason it was interesting was they didn't have a storefront. The second thing it was interesting is that they like you could create like a burrito menu and name it like Sam's Burritos. And then you could create like James's quesadilla company, and then you could create Sam's curry company. But it's really all three are the same location, same place. They just throw these menus online on Uber Eats, and then just make stuff as it comes in. Do you know what I mean?
That's a brilliant idea, because it's sort of like that whole thing where, you know, if you order on Seamless or Grubhub or whatever, and this happens to me frequently. There's like a sushi place that I'll love and I'll order from all the time. But then when you actually pass it and you see it in the street and it's like this dirty hole in the wall, you're like shocked. But this is a good way to, what I'm saying is, I never actually normally see the restaurants I order from. So what makes the difference if they have a storefront, if they're just in some closet somewhere?
Right. And you can like rapidly test different things. Like, when I started my hot dog stands in college, I started with like $500. I mean, I would imagine you could start in the similar ballpark of a couple grand. You could start a restaurant and you could be like, let's just see if New York City really wants like this genre of food, and we'll just throw this menu on Uber Eats and see if we can get any traction and rapidly test. And you could use that, the profits from that, to fund a storefront, to fund this other stuff. And I think it's cool. You know, I think a really cool example of a food business is Halal Guys in New York.
Yeah.
And
they must make a ton of money. There's huge lines. I mean, I don't know about now, but there's huge lines in the middle of the workday for lunch.
Well, they franchised it out. So now there's Halal Guys in San Francisco. And it all started with a food truck or a stand or whatever you want to call those carts. Anyway, cloud kitchens are the way to go right now.
And how do I find, let's say I want to do this. Let's say I want to start cooking James's burritos. And how do I find a cloud kitchen near me?
Well, that's where there's a lot of opportunity actually right now. So Travis Kalanick, the founder of Uber, actually just started a company called Cloud Kitchens. And the whole idea is that you can use their space and start it up. But basically, when I started my hot dog stands in college, what I had to do was I had to find what was called a commissary. So it's a bar, or it's a kitchen that is registered with the government as a place to prepare food. So for example, I used a bar. So I gave a bar like I think $200 a month, and I just kept my food in their freezer, and I was selling hot dogs. There was nothing really to prepare other than chop onions. And anyway, I would pay them like $200 a month, and I would keep my stuff there, and I would prepare my food there, and then I would go out and sell. And so to start a cloud kitchen, I don't know for sure, but I imagine you would need a commissary or some type of proper kitchen where you're able to do this, and you could pay $200 to $1,000 a month, I bet. And then you can just submit your business license and EIN number to Uber Eats and create a menu, and I bet you can start immediately.
So let's say...
And I don't know this for a fact. I'm just saying this is what I did with food trucks and stands and stuff, and I bet it's similar.
So the bar had a kitchen, but they didn't want to make food in there other than like French fries or
something?
Well, no,
they did, but like basically if you like, you just, I didn't know them, but I just walked in and I said, hey, so here's the deal. I want to start this thing selling stuff outside of your place late at night. You guys don't serve food at night. I'll pay you I forget how much money I paid, like $300 a month. And I'll just let me have this really small corner in your freezer. I won't bother anyone. I won't touch anything. I'll even clean up and sweep for you guys. And that's it. I just need this by law.
And I guess they benefit not only from the $300, which is, so I own a bar in New York City, $300 wouldn't do much for us, but, where they do benefit, and where I would benefit now, is having food right outside the bar, because then customers, you know, you get foot traffic from the food, but also sometimes your customers in the bar want food, and if you don't have food, it's like, oh, did that bar let customers bring hot dogs in, have hot dogs and a drink?
Yeah, that was like the shtick. Was that we would work together. But now there's all these companies, which is what Travis Kalanick does, and all they are is commissaries. And so they make it really easy to launch these cloud kitchens because it's booming. They're booming right now. I mean, think about it. Like, what is what's like a New York-only brand? I don't know. There's a bunch of cool stuff. Like, there's like a bunch of like cool places in New York where there's only like 3 or 4 locations. And I could just spin that up in San Francisco using Uber Eats, and it would cost me nothing. I mean, it would cost me single digit thousands of dollars, or maybe low tens of thousands of dollars to start that up and to only have it exist on Uber Eats, versus getting a lease, which would be 10 grand a month, getting furniture. I mean, it would easily cost $500,000 to start just a cute chain in San Francisco, whereas if you do it on cloud kitchens, the costs are significantly lower. So,
right. So let's say there's a restaurant chain that has got a full menu and it's very popular, but it's just in New York City, which, by the way, originally was like Shake Shack, for instance.
Yeah.
So let's take Shake Shack before it spread all over. And you could be in San Francisco. You rent some space in a commissary. You serve Shake Shack style hamburgers, and maybe you pay Shake Shack some sort of license fee as well.
Yeah.
But they'll do it cheap because you're just doing an experiment. And then now it's Shake Shack on Uber Eats. How much do you think, how much business do you think you could generate?
In a big city, I mean, San Francisco, in terms of population, isn't big, but in terms of people who use Uber Eats, it's quite large. I mean, I think you would make single-digit millions of dollars. I think that the way that I would model it out is like Subway. Subway is, did you know that Subway, I think Subway has more locations than any other fast food chain in the country.
I think Subway is 27,000 and McDonald's is 14,000 in the U.S. And I think Starbucks is around 14,000 as well.
So Subway is huge. And the reason why Subway is huge is if you go to a small town, so I'm from Missouri and I've hung out a lot in Tennessee and Alabama and all these small towns. Oftentimes, a small town won't have a McDonald's because they're quite expensive to start.
Yeah, about $2 million you might end up spending to start a McDonald's.
Yeah, and I think the average location might gross the net income after all said and done. I think a good McDonald's is about $1 million, maybe 800,000. I forget exactly, but anyway, a Subway, you could probably start a Subway with a quarter of a million or less. Because you only need two people at a time to work there, and you don't need a fryer, and you don't need a bunch of other stuff. And so if I was to do this, I would just look at kind of how Subway set it up, and I would just copy that, because that's the way to go.
Wait, in terms of setting up a restaurant or in setting up a...
In terms of what expectations are that I can make, yeah. Because the cost structure is probably more similar to a Subway than it is
But minus the rent, right?
Yeah. Minus the rent.
Because the $250,000, that includes rent?
Yeah, leasing a location. But in terms of opportunities right now, cloud kitchens, I think that's super interesting. I personally don't think I would want to do it as my main gig, but if I was interested in food and wanted to make money in food, that's what I would do.
I think that's an enormous idea because think about movie theaters right now. A lot of people are saying movie theaters are going out of business. And by the way, I think AMC even is flirting with bankruptcy at the moment. Universal just released a movie, the sequel to another movie that I had never heard of. Universal released something like Trolls Without Borders, grossed $95 million in the past 3 weeks, going straight to on demand. And they got 80% of the cut as opposed to with a movie theater where they probably would have grossed less money and only got 50% of the cut. And so AMC said to Universal, screw you, we're not going to run your movies anymore. Meanwhile, AMC is the one about to go bankrupt. But what if you take these movie theaters and turn them into 30 kitchens?
It's interesting. I think that's going to happen with malls too.
Yeah, you think malls will just turn... What do you think malls will turn into?
My philosophy was to turn them into nursing homes.
Oh, yeah. That could be interesting.
I've always wanted malls to turn into nursing homes. I'm super fascinated with what's going to happen to mall real estate. I've always thought that malls would be great schools or great nursing homes.
But even schools are falling apart right now. So a mall is interesting because some of them are huge, right? So is it too big for a nursing home? Or are you just assuming, we've got 70 million boomers that are all going to be old in the next 20 years.
Dude, nursing homes are so expensive. Do you know how, I think, what's a good nursing home cost? I mean, I'm thankful that I'm not in a situation where I have to worry about that at the moment. But a good nursing home could be $15,000, $20,000 a month. It's so expensive.
Who pays for that usually?
I don't fucking know.
Because that's expensive rent. You can't, we were just discussing earlier, you can't spend that for a house.
$15,000 a month in rent? What? How much is you pay more than $15,000 a month in rent?
I do, but I'm in New York City.
How big's your place?
3,000 square feet.
In Manhattan?
Yeah, in Upper West Side.
And it's more than $15,000? Fucking A. I feel like, what would be the cap rate on that real estate? $15,000 would be, if it's 5%, so that'd be, what's the place worth then? If it's more than $15,000, would the place have to be worth $4 million?
I would say this place, if it was for sale right now, would probably go for before the pandemic, I don't know about now, it would probably go for between 7 and 8 million.
That's fucking crazy.
Yeah, yeah. But that's why I would never own. For me, I think ownership is insane. For me, I can scale up or scale down you know, year by year, or sometimes even month by month. Like I used to just live in Airbnbs. So I could scale up or scale down just depending on how much money I made that month. And by the way, I do plan on going broke again. I'm sort of known for going broke and bouncing back.
I know.
I'm going to go broke again. So I just spend what I want. I like the apartment. I've got 5 kids.
That's crazy.
And sometimes they're all under one house. So, but yeah, like, but malls though are so big. You're right. Malls are going to go into bankruptcy. And so you're probably going to be able to buy some malls cheap.
Man, I thought they were going to go into bankruptcy. Have you seen the REITs right now? Like the commercial REITs right now, they're still crushing.
I don't understand how that could be, because take New York City or take San Francisco. WeWork is probably the biggest renter in New York City and San Francisco, just in terms of like rent. I mean, if you own a building and WeWork owns or is renting 8 floors in that building, and then they just disappear. Like they're not going to clean up before they go bankrupt. They're just going to disappear. What's that building owner going to do? He can't rent that space anytime soon, but they still have to pay all the loans back. So it seems, and that's just WeWork. Other businesses are going to be scaling down because of new remote working. Restaurant storefronts, clothing storefronts. These are all going to go empty. You can't rent a restaurant space in a building to a non-restaurant. It's got the kitchen. It's made to be a restaurant. So what are commercial REITs going to do? These real estate companies, they have to go. This guy has to be a financial crisis again after this financial crisis.
Yeah, it's weird. And it doesn't make sense to me. I've pulled my money from the market. I feel like just a plebe. I'm just an idiot. I don't understand any of this. I don't know why it's working the way it is.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone does, but I think there's a lot of uncertainty right now. So I also have been not active at all because there's just too much uncertainty. The market's at the same level it was a few months ago when we were at full employment and the economy was growing. Now the economy's shrinking and there's like 20% unemployment or more. It's a lot different situation. But the flip side is there's all the stimulus, but we don't know where that stimulus is going to end up. But I like this kind of thinking though of like what's going. We know malls are in trouble. Like JCPenney just declared bankruptcy. Neiman Marcus just declared bankruptcy. So all these flagship stores of malls are sort of anchored by these flagships. And so we know malls are going to have problems, and there's probably going to be some malls that go out of business. And I don't know, do you think it's possible to buy an obscure mall cheap, or they're still huge?
Yeah, I think your perspective is skewed because you live in New York, but we just looked at real estate before this. I mean, I bet you could buy a mall in Missouri where I live for, I don't know how that would work. It would be complicated because you'd have to have probably a lot of improvements. I bet you could buy a mall for $3 million.
Yeah, and so then if you figure each bed you're charging $180,000 a year for, and a mall can probably fit like 1,000 beds, that's, you know, well, that's,
yeah, it's interesting.
Million.
I know people in the nursing home business, and it's booming. Well, not right now with everyone getting sick. I mean, they're still making money, but it's like next to like a prison and a cruise ship is like nursing home is in terms of getting sick. It's like you're trapped in there. So not fun now, but historically it definitely is a money-making business.
Yeah, and there's 72 million baby boomers alive right now in the US, and they're all going to be, you know, elderly within the next few years. I mean, the baby boom is from 1946 to 1964. So even the people born in 1964, well, I guess they've got another 15 years before they start considering this, but people born in 1946, how old are they right now? They're 60, no, they're like 80 years old now.
Yeah.
Or no, they're like 75 years old. Can't add
yet. Old enough to be in the ballpark.
Yeah. So, okay, that's an idea. So we've got cloud kitchens. We've got malls turning into nursing homes. Let's do it, man. Let's do an idea factory here. So, okay, you wouldn't do the food truck. You'd rather just sort of sit around and go into this hole-in-the-wall kitchen, make hamburgers like Sam's Burgers here, Sam's Taco
Burgers.
Yeah,
I mean, look, so here's – I've thought about this. So New York is actually a great case study. You guys have all these stupid viral foods like rainbow bagels or like cronuts or whatever. Like yeah. they're all, like all these cute things. And here's how it works. They like they take food. I've spent so much time thinking about this. They take food that's typically a side and they make it the main thing. Like instead of cookie dough ice cream, it's just like cookie dough with no ice cream. So you just buy cookie dough. Or they take normal food and they make it a weird color or a weird shape. So like really big things, really small things, purple, ketchup, whatever. They just like, it's like colors. Or they combine two foods, Krona or like freaking like, I don't know. You
Wait,
can-
I would write this down. Hold on a second. So take a side and make it a dish. So
yeah, take a side like and make fries? It a main thing. So yeah, like just a French fry bar. Okay, you just take a side and you make it the main thing. Or like, what's like a side typically? Like hash browns. Okay, hash browns. Just make it only hash browns. You just take a side and you make it the main thing. That's
Would
like
anyone order delivery from a place that's just hash browns?
Potatoes, actually, this is interesting. Potatoes are actually one of the hardest foods to ship. So Uber Eats had a whole team that worked on McDonald's to try to get French fries to your home in a fresh way. So potatoes historically are very hard to ship. But like, what's a side? I don't know.
Like broccoli.
Yeah, just make it like the best.
Or I've got an idea. What if it's all sides? So the menu is just, you know, broccoli, pancetta, you know, fries, hash browns. Because sometimes I just go to a restaurant and sometimes I just order the sides.
Yeah, so just the side has to be the main thing. The second thing is it has to be, or it doesn't have to be. This is like another angle is it's a normal food, but or like cookie dough. That's what I said. So like instead of like chocolate chip cookie dough, just cookie dough. That's like your thing. The second thing is you take a normal food and you make it either a weird size or a weird shape. So like for example, if you have like an ice cream place again, you just make it like the biggest cone there is, or if you have a bagel, you make it purple as opposed to like you guys in New York have like rainbow cookies or something. Is that like a thing? Rainbow cake?
I don't know. I wouldn't know.
That's like a thing.
I eat like basically the same thing every day.
And then what's the other one? And then you take two foods that seem a little bit weird and you just combine them.
Melissa's Baked Goods. I forget the name of the company, but they do cupcakes, but they're really tiny and they're like a dollar.
Yeah. So yes, I've been there. Okay. So you do one of those three things. There's actually a few more categories that I've written out, but.
Combine two foods. Is that like, let's say I made couscous tacos?
Yeah, that's a shit combination, but you're on the right track.
Why is that? I would eat that. Why is that a shit combination?
Well, maybe it's not. I don't know. Like, it could be.
What's your favorite combo? What would you do?
Like, I think they have to be two combos in the same category. So, like, Taco Bell, and if we're going to talk about tacos, Mexican food, Taco Bell does this, where they just take, it's all the same shit, but they just call it cuter names. So, like, if they, like, combine a taco and a quesadilla, like it's all just a tortilla, meat, and cheese, but they like somehow call it like the gordito crunch or something like that.
See, I like when you combine two ethnic foods. So like in New York, there's a lot of Cuban Chinese restaurants, and you know that's kind of you know this. And in San Francisco, there's a lot of quote unquote fusion, which is really like a mix of lots of
sushi burritos and things like Sushi Rito. That's actually a restaurant. It's called Sushi Rito.
That's so funny. And so what's another combination? Just I'm stretching your brain here.
For some reason in San Francisco, the Indian people make a lot of pizza. And so they try to make like Indian style pizza.
That's great. Now I'm still trying to think of just realistically, am I going to order cookie dough through Uber Eats? Like that's the only one where I don't know. You still might need a small storefront. I'm trying to figure out
maybe. Oh no, I've already no. So let's go to the next step. I'm going to tell you how to get customers. Okay, so yeah. Thrillist, BuzzFeed, and all these places, they just all here. You just get you either get a line or you get a picture of people going being frantic about your shit, and you make the whole story two things: one about how ridiculous this food is, and two, how hipsters in Williamsburg or Madison Square Park are like waiting in line to eat it.
And so you write the article and you send it to Thrillist?
Well, I would make a video. I would make my own video of it, and then I would put like $500 behind it on Facebook and Instagram videos, and then I would post it on the subreddit of New York City, and it would get picked up.
That's great. So and you would say this is ridiculous. They're getting like.
Yeah,
they're standing in line for cupcakes that are like millimeters long, and then
People are waiting in line to order a cup of cookie dough. What the hell? And it's purple cookie dough, or like fondue is like the latest rage in New York City. It doesn't matter if it is or is not. You just say that. But this is just how it works.
But this is where you have a storefront.
Yeah,
but this is when you have a storefront. Though.
But you don't want that storefront because you want to be able to change that shit because it gets old fast. So you just got to come up with new shticks every 6 months.
But how do you do the video if people aren't online because you don't have a storefront because you're just doing a delivery?
Yeah, I mean, you just got to figure out how to get people to line up. I don't know. I would have to. I need to adapt.
Or what's the regulations? Like, if you have if you're cooking in a kitchen, can you go on the sidewalk and set up a stand?
There's rules for what you can sell on a stand, but yeah, you could.
Or I guess there are like food markets, so you can. So like once a quarter, you could go to some parade where they're opening up stands on the sidewalk.
Yeah, or like, here's one. You guys have this out here, a ramen. You guys have like these ramen cheeseburgers. You ever had that?
No, but that sounds like a good combo.
Like instead of a bun, it's like ramen that's stuck together.
I like that because I actually eat, you know, those like 25 cent ramen noodle packages you could buy?
Yeah.
I like them dry. So just
that's what it is. It's dry. It's that dry stuff with beef in between. So anyway, you want to start a restaurant there. That's what you do. I just gave you the rules for how to get popular. I don't know if it will be sustainable, but you certainly can make a splash.
Now, wait, are we mostly talking, though, this is for delivery?
I would do that. I could do that for delivery. Man, you can manipulate this shit so easily. You just got to put some money behind it on Facebook ads and Instagram ads and target it to people who live in Williamsburg.
And that's so funny. Yeah, I wonder what would work in the Upper West Side because that's a little bit more older family, conservative, you know, not politically, but just in terms of their habits. But, you know, everybody likes cookie dough. So I'm curious about the idea of taking a side dish and making it the main thing. I can see that working as a small storefront. Like there are storefronts in New York City where it's just rice pudding. It might even be called rice or pudding or something like that. But would you set up a kitchen that had no storefront that was just a side dish like cookie dough? Like would people order just cookie dough for delivery?
Yeah. Hell yeah, dude. I don't know if there's such thing as like Google's search analytics for Uber Eats search, but like in 2009, when YouTube just launched, I used to make these viral videos and it was pretty scammy. But it was literally just a picture and there was nothing on it. And it would rack up all this views and ad revenue. And all you would do is you would type in like one word and it would autofill with stuff. And that's how you would see what to make your title of your video by what would autofill. I bet you can do that with Uber Eats right now. You just type in any like food word and it will autofill with something. And that will show you what people are searching for.
So if I type in cookie,
yeah,
and cookie dough is the first thing that tells me, hey, maybe people really do specifically only want cookie dough sometimes.
Yeah, that would totally work.
And so that's interesting about YouTube. Do you think that same strategy works right now
for YouTube?
Yeah.
No.
Like, what's an example video that you did?
I'll tell you. it was some shady
shit. He says reluctantly.
So I'll preface this by saying I was 16 years old. But like, for example, I used to watch like street fight videos on YouTube. And if you would type in like people's races, like white guy or black guy, it would autofill with like white guy beats up black guy or black guy beats up white guy. It would autofill. And if you just make that the title and you just put a picture of it, I would get a million views in a month. On a video,
and why do you think that doesn't work anymore?
One, it was a scam. I mean, it wasn't a scam. I wasn't stealing from anyone, but it was shit. It was clickbait. Why doesn't it work anymore? because one,
like, let's say you had a legit video of, you know, two white guys fighting, and you realize that would be the best title through this YouTube search idea.
Well, I think it would help you. The you could use that to help, but now, like back then, which wasn't even long ago, it was 10 years ago, there wasn't such thing as YouTube search analytics, and now you could definitely use that to rank. And there also weren't that many creators, so there was an oversupply, or there was a huge demand but little supply, so I could game the system really easily. Now, you know, there's a massive amount of supply and a massive amount of demand, so it's met a little bit easier. And also, people are smarter, so it's not easy to trick people into clicking into stuff, or it's not as easy.
And what would you make when you were 16 years old on one video like that?
Hundreds of dollars a month on ad revenue.
Man, so you didn't need a paper route.
Yeah, I made hundreds of dollars a month. So enough for a 16-year-old.
And on the food truck, is there a lot of... So later on, you did a food truck. Are there a lot of regulations for...
No, I did a food cart.
A food cart.
I did a food stand. Yeah, and that's actually a big... So you're asking about regulations. That's one of the distinctions. So... There's two things. One, there's a difference between something that you step into and something that you are pulled behind a car and you're outside of. So if you can step into something, that's one thing. If you can't step into it, that's a different thing. And there's a reason why there's hot dog stands, because by law, in I think 49 of the 50 states, you can only sell a Frankfurter, which is considered cased meat that is already cooked. And so you could typically only sell things that were pre-cooked, and you could eat them raw or heated up, and it would not make you sick either way. And that's why there's hot dog stands as opposed to cheesesteak stands. Like you need a totally different – there's a different set of rules for selling cooked beef as there is for selling Frankfurters. And so I opened up a hot dog stand because that was the cheapest one.
And so what just out of curiosity, you know, what are you gaming now? What are you seeing as, you know, other than malls turning into nursing homes, which I like that idea too. You know, it might even be possible to, like, if a mall is in receivership, like if a mall company goes bankrupt, you might not even have to buy the mall. You could probably just, like, rent space or lease for a long period of time, or get seller financing from the courts just to get it off the books. Yeah. From the bankrupt company. But anyway, what other things, what are you looking into gaming right now?
I don't game anything. I mean, I definitely was like a hacker, and I mean, first of all, everything I do is legitimate. In order to create sustainable wealth and large amounts of wealth, it's definitely much easier if you just do everything legitimately and build a brand that people love and actually trust and like, because then you could create anything or sell anything. So I try not to game anything. I mean, the hustle.
But it doesn't sound like you were gaming the hot dog stand. I mean, that
no, was I wasn't gaming it. I mean, I was taking advantage of opportunity. So, so long as gaming doesn't mean illegal and means creating shit that people actually like, but I'm just playing a game to win, then yes, yeah. I did. Now, I mean, with the hustle, with email, like, we built this big 8-figure company, or I mean, that's not big, but meaningful sized, and it's going to be, I think we'll do hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue, and it started with email, so that we definitely gained that. I mean, you're associated with a company that has made potentially billions of dollars, and it started with email as well. And so a lot of people are shocked by that email can be that big. And so we definitely, in the sense of like...
Email could be huge.
We gamed email in the sense of like we built this large thing off of the back of email.
Well, how did you... So, okay, describe the hustle. It's kind of a business entrepreneurial newsletter.
By the way, you interviewed me the day we launched the hustle. I don't know if you know that, but you did.
That's so funny. I'm losing my memory. I'm over the age of 50 now, so I'm totally losing my memory. When did you launch it?
We turned four... 4 years old, like a few days ago. So 4 years ago, it started. So I had a company that I sold for a very, very small amount of money. And then I started a conference called HustleCon. And in order to make the conference popular, I created a newsletter. And I was like, this content thing, it's kind of cool. Let's pursue that, see what's going on there. And I would just blog like crazy. I would write like two or three blog posts a day. and it started getting some traction. But I realized that creating a blog and making money off a blog is really, really hard because you got to get traffic from Facebook every day, and it's quite challenging. And so we go, well, this newsletter works for HustleCon, our event. What if we just only did that? And so that's what we did, was we said, let's just create news and information, but deliver it only through email. And when we, the way that we got our first maybe 250,000 subscribers in a year was I would use that like popular virally content that I wrote on our blog. And that is why you covered us, is because we did some controversial and wild things that are for our blog.
And how did you then, how did you make the shift? How did you translate them over to subscribing for your email newsletter? Like, did you offer any kind of giveaway or?
No, not at first. At first it was strictly, the content was great. I mean, it was good content. I learned how to write well. I knew how to write in a way where people would read something and they'd be like, oh, wow, this is a little bit different than what I've been scrolling through all day. And I got really good at writing pop-ups. So the pop-up that would show up, I'm a self-taught copywriter, so I learned how to grab people's attention and to get them to fall down the slippery slope of like, what is this website that I'm on? This is kind of cool. What is going on here? And so I got really good at just writing. It was just all through the written word that we would get let's say 1 million people a month to our website, and we would convert 5% of them to become email subscribers. So that's about 50,000. You do that for a few months, and it starts adding up.
Yeah, how many subscribers do you have right now? For the free,
say it again.
How many subscribers for your basic newsletter do you have right now?
For the Hustle, we have closer to 2 million than 1 million at this point.
That's great! Congratulations. And then I guess what are the best ways you find to monetize it?
So the plan all along was twofold. Was one, let's monetize. So we built this advertising sales team and we built our own technology. Like, there's no such thing as like an email ad network. I mean, there's a couple people that are trying to do it, but there's nothing significant. And so we built our own email advertising network and we built our own technology to advertise in the email. But the plan all along was let's create profits through advertising in the email, and let's use all those products or profits to create more products to launch to our list. And so that's where Trends came in. So we launched Trends maybe 8 months ago, and that's a paid subscription. And I'm gonna launch more and more products to them.
Do you do affiliate deals, or it's just mostly, because I would imagine with affiliate deals, you don't have to launch your own products. You could take 50% of products you throw people to.
Correct, and we did do that when we first started. I'm more interested in launching and owning the brands because I find that to be more exciting. The model that I basically ripped off completely was SoftBank. I don't know if you know this, but SoftBank started as a PC magazine of Japan, and they also owned a conference, and that conference is now called CES in Las Vegas.
Oh, yeah.
They bought into that. And anyway, what Masa Sun, the founder, the guy who we read about now in the news because he's kind of a wild man, he would see which advertisements were doing best in his publication, and then he would launch those companies. He would either invest in them or launch them, and that's what I want to do.
That's interesting. So you have advertisers, and if they keep on advertising, that tells you they're doing well. And what would you do, approach them about investing? Or you would launch your own competitor?
I study our audience like crazy. And I'm like, man, what's doing well? Like, what type of copy works for them? What do they like? And which of our advertisers are doing best? I mean, we knew before the Zoom IPO that they were going to take off like a rocket. And I knew that because I saw how people responded to it. And so immediately our sales guy were like, hey, I think this company Zoom, they're going to fucking crush it when they go public. And I know this because I know how much they're paying to acquire a customer. I know how our audience is reacting to it. I see what's going on behind the scenes. I mean, we could send them like 10,000, 20,000 clicks to their website, and they would tell us like what's going on. And so when they went public, all of our guys bought a ton of stock. And that's just one tiny example, but you can see what works well. I mean, you know how it is. Like, when you have a big email list, you can see a lot of really cool insights into customer behavior.
Yeah. you always write about interesting topics in The Hustle. And there's one thing I saw recently on your website is, or it was just recently, which is the, again, there's always these interesting ideas that makes me think, but the minor celebrity exchange or app or whatever that is, that is like an interesting idea.
Yeah. So we have we had a bigger team, but now we pretty much just have two guys and they just spend all day finding cool stories to write about. And they just find that shit every single day. They're total news nerds and they love this. And we just try to find interesting stuff every single day and analyze it.
Yeah, that's an odd idea because it's true. Like there's a lot more minor celebrities than there are Brad Pitts. And if you're a small business and you want a minor celebrity to like, I was surprised even Gilbert Gottfried, he's been a comedian for like 60 years. Even he was on there. And if you're a minor, if you're a business and you have like Gilbert Gottfried saying, oh, I always eat these, you know, sushi Ritos. That's not a bad kind of exchange.
Yeah, that's what people, you know, and are you referring to Cameo? Was that the one we talked about?
I forget the name of it. It's in one.
But I think, yeah, I know what you're talking about. I think it was called Cameo. Yeah, I got my best man at my wedding got Gilbert Gottfried to send me a video telling me like I'm lame or something like that. And yeah, it's awesome. I love that. I love that service.
What are, so I've used it for other things or?
I just use it for pranks. I just will like have like my wife's favorite reality TV show host, like tell her that she's awesome or something like that.
And how much does that guy make by doing this?
You can see the prices. Him, I paid $200. It's actually that's like the greatest way to see which celebrities are broke is by how much they charge.
Wow. So that really moves the needle for him. Like he'll do that.
Well, like how do they, if I pay, let's say I said, James, I will pay you $50 for a 2-minute video. No. Actually, if I said, I'm going to have 100 people request a 2-minute video from you, how much money would I have to pay you per video to make it interesting to you?
I don't know. Actually, $5,000.
Okay, well then that just shows how much money you have. That's like if
I don't know, or maybe it just shows that I'm lazy.
Well, if you're broke, you're going to be willing to do that shit for $50. It just shows you have options.
Yeah, that's funny. So again, you write about so many different interesting like business models and like creative business models, even in this environment. What strikes you right now, other than what we just talked about with food and nursing homes, what strikes you right now as an interesting business model? By the way, I do think information products are the best business model. So The Hustle is the best business model of all. But what else is out there that you think is interesting for people to start?
So like we have The Hustle and then we have Trends. And what Trends does is we've hired a team of analysts and all we do is go out and like reverse engineer cool stuff and like write it, do case studies. And we have all these data points that show like what we think is going to be popular. And it's freaking awesome. It's just like my own playground because I like to go out and invest in angel investing companies. And this just tells me what to do. And I love it.
What trends do you see happening right now, particularly it's sort of hard to see for sure, other than like basic stuff like commercial real estate's going to fall apart. It's hard to really predict post shutdown what's going to flourish and what's going to die in the next 12 months.
It's hard to predict, but I don't think that's the right word that I'm looking for. What I'm looking for is what's possible. And so I like to look at what are consumers or businesses demanding and how are people doing things in other countries or other regions of the world? And basically what's working at a small level already and it's growing, even if it's just growing just a little bit. And then to try to understand, can that be done at a much larger rate? And is there still more room in the marketplace for things similar to that? So I'll give you examples. Something that is near and dear to my heart is news. I think that in the next 10 years, I think there's going to be a massive amount of new companies that are giving news to young-ish people, and they're going to charge money for it. I don't think, since the launch of the internet, it's been weird to pay for information like news, and I think that's going to change significantly. I'm incredibly bullish on small local newspapers, and I think that they're going to thrive in the next 10 years, and I think there's going to be a lot of new companies that are exploiting and pouncing on that opportunity. So I'm fascinated by that. I like to look at how the Chinese and the Japanese monetize news, and it's amazing. They do it so much better than Americans, and I think that
how do they do it?
Subscription. In Japan, I mean, there's multiple companies. Japan and China, there are multiple companies that charge you money for news, and they also have advertising, and young people find it normal to pay for that. And I think that that's going to be common in America, actually. I think that this whole Trump fake news thing, I don't care what side of the aisle you fall in, I think that everyone agrees that it's kind of weird that, like, it's easy to trick people into believing stuff, and young people's bullshit detector is quite high. And one of the best ways to circumvent someone's bullshit detector is not to bullshit. And if you can do that effectively, you can charge money for your information. And I think that that's going to happen a lot.
I agree with you, and I'm interested in your thoughts on this. Like, I was looking at an article the other day on one of the, let's say, the top three news websites out there, and the headline said, CDC chief says highly likely that a second wave will be far more dangerous than the first wave. And so I'm like, okay, they got me. I clicked on that, and the only quote from the CDC chief was, there is a possibility that if coronavirus comes back in a second wave, it might intersect with the flu, making it more complex to diagnose. That was the line, which they then translated, you know, there is a possibility to, it's highly likely. So that's, and this was a major, well-known, you know, A-plus brand news site. And it was just clearly they were lying.
Yeah.
And so,
it's easy. Look, I've done it before. I know how you and I both know how the game works. It's easy to get people to do shit online just to steal a little bit of their attention. But I just think that the average consumer is incredibly sophisticated. I think that a lot of creators kind of like dump stuff down for people. And I don't think that that's the right way to go. I think that the average person is really, really, really smart when it comes to like internet tricks. And so I believe that people are going to pay, like behavior is going to change and sentiment's going to change, and people are going to pay for information. So that's one trend that I think is going to be huge. And I think that there's a lot of ways to pounce on it.
How will that be different from, like, right now, for instance, you have to pay if you want to see the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post or the New York Times. Like, how would it differ from that?
Well, I think there's going to be a room for a ton of more companies similar to that. Historically, from like the 1920s to the 1990s, newspapers were amazing companies. I mean, Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett would invest heavily in newspapers, particularly small local newspapers, and they would try to own 100 of them because it was an awesome company. They knew it was very predictable. It would last for decades. And I think that we might see some more things like that. I think that, like, if I'm from St. Louis, I think that you could start a St. Louis, an Omaha, a Birmingham, a Nashville, a Denver local company that creates news and information for these smallish cities. And I think you could own 50 of them and make a killing.
Yeah, that's interesting. All right, what's another one? What's getting interesting to you now?
I really like one thing that we discovered that I found incredibly fascinating is various niche audio. I don't even know what the right word is. Audio, basically audio porn. So, like, people, particularly, well, mostly all young women who are willing to pay for romance novels. So, do you know anything about romance novels?
Not really, no.
Man, it's a crazy popular category. It might be the most popular category. It might have the most liquidity in the marketplace on Amazon books. So
I do believe that. I do know that's the extent of my knowledge about romance novels.
Yeah, so like most people just know it by seeing Fabio on the cover of a book at the grocery store at the checkout aisle. But the reason it's there is because it's so popular. But romance novels have massive amounts of liquidity in the meaning that a lot of new ones pop up. And a lot of them are sold. And what this means is you've got a lot of amateur writers who just do this because they freaking love it. They just want to launch. They love writing these books. And then you have a lot of readers who consume this stuff like crazy, like men do porn. They just, like, it's like an addiction almost. And so one thing that I'm really fascinated about is there's a handful of new apps that were launched that are okay businesses, $20-30 million a year businesses. And what they do is they do thriller and fiction novels for young teens, and you charge them money in order to see them and read them. And I think that what's going to happen is audio romance novels, I call it audio porn. It's not actually porn, but I don't know how you define porn, but romance novels in the form of audio, that could take off like a rocket. And I actually invested in a company that did something similar. And they ended up closing the company down because they pivoted the business and went a different route. But there's still a lot of room in that market for someone to pounce on that. I think that's going to explode.
So don't most romance novels already make the audiobook versions and they're for sale on Amazon?
Yeah, but there's a lot of really, really cool niche communities that are actually quite large. So for example, there's a company called Wattpad. Have you heard of Wattpad?
Yeah. Love Wattpad.
Yeah.
I tried to invest in them actually, right? But I missed, it was right after they just closed around where I met the CEO and I really wanted to invest and I was trying to, you know, sell the value of me. And he was like, nah, I can't. We just closed the round. But they're huge.
Yeah. So I don't know what they do in revenue. If you told me they did north of $100 million in revenue, I wouldn't be surprised. But I do know that they've raised, how much you would know? $200 million maybe?
Yeah. I mean, when I met them like 6 years ago. So at the time, they had an $80 million valuation. So they're much bigger now. I don't know where they're at now.
Yeah. So Wattpad's a good example. If I remember correctly, I believe a lot of their highest grossing authors are... So first of all, we should explain what Wattpad is. Wattpad is a... I don't know. How do you describe it? Like a community-driven story?
So by the way, both myself and my daughter have written on Wattpad. It's basically you could write... You could write short stories. You could write anything, and it's a social. It's like a social network. So you start getting fans and followers, and people are alerted when you write something new. So it's just like it's almost like fanfiction.net. You could write fan fiction, or you could just write your own stories, and you build up like a social network. You build up followers and connections, and so on.
Yeah, so
it's like a social network for writing.
And some of their most popular categories are romance novels. And so what I love to do is I love to look at these websites that have communities, so like Reddit, Wattpad, things like that. And I like to look at where are some of the most passionate sub-communities within that large communities, and then create things just for them. That's kind of like how Twitch got started, is they looked at what's this niche community inside of Justin TV that seems to have the most passion, and let's create stuff just for them. And I think that that's where the opportunity lives in this category. The only reason why I'm not doing it is because I don't really care about that. I mean, that doesn't interest me. But it definitely could interest the right person.
Yeah, it's interesting because, so you would go to someone on Wattpad, let's say a popular romance author who hasn't been doing audio or anything and has nothing published on Amazon. And you would say, hey, I'm going to buy the audio rights of what you wrote on Wattpad, or we'll go 50-50 and I'll help you produce the audio and I'll be in charge of selling it. You put it for sale on Amazon and boom, you get...
Yeah, I wouldn't go that route. I would create a dedicated experience to where you do a handful of things to where you get cliffhangers. And so what you do is you have these short 8-minute audio stories and you have it. So like each night the woman can hear like the next iteration of a particular story and you pay $10 a month for it. And you get and you have various experiences, almost like the meditation apps, but for romance novels.
How would you build up an audience for that, or would you let the content creator who already has a big audience on Wattpad?
Yep.
You let them just market it to their subscribers already.
That's exactly what I would do, as well as paid advertising. I think that you could do a massive arbitrage with paid advertising.
Yeah. So what else? What's next? I'm gonna keep pounding you for what's next.
Well, a lot of the things I was paying attention to were pre-corona. So in terms of pre-corona, I was very bullish on trade shows. So basically there's a whole subset. I mean, I sound almost stupid talking about this because this was only 60 days ago, but like everything's freaking changed. But prior, and I think it will go back, but prior to this whole stuff, there was a company called Informa. Have you heard of Informa?
No.
So Informa is a, again, everything I'm saying, just reverse it 60 days. But Informa was like it's a B2B media company based out of England, and they own roughly 80 to 100 brands. And they were publicly traded in England at about a $14 billion valuation. They did about $3 billion a year in revenue and sales. and they would host trade shows for B2B industries. And I was very fascinated in the trade show industry because I thought that it was traditionally quite old school, not very technology driven. I felt like they did use a lot of really bad ticketing platforms. And I was super fascinated by it. And from my research, I think that there was opportunities in the market for construction trade shows, oil trade shows. And I did a whole case study where I broke down how they make money. Like each event could make like $50 million and the margins.
You're kidding.
No, yeah. Yeah. And the margins would be massive. And so what you would do is you and I know about this business. What you do is you get sponsors or vendors to do a trade show. You charge them money to be there and to have a booth. And what you have to do is you have to make it so when you go to this event, you have speakers, and the content of the speakers attract a particular type of audience. But the way that you make the real money is you have to have buyers and sellers who are going to transact. And so, for example, I would create a I don't know anything about the construction industry, but I would create a construction trade show for builders of multifamily homes, and I would create a trade show for that. And I would get people who have supplies for building multifamily homes, and then I would create content that attracts people who buy like loads of multifamily homes. And if you do it, you have to have that transaction there. And the booths you charge tens of thousands of dollars for, in hopes that they will at least make a handful of new customers to justify that expense. And then you make but those vendors actually pay for the hard cost of producing your show, and then the profit comes in through the sales of tickets. And so what you have to do is you have to find niches in which those transactions can happen and cover and justify tens of thousands of dollars charging to a vendor. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. What about now doing these things on Zoom, like Zoom trade shows?
Yeah. And so now everything has changed. I still think that industry is going to crush. And I think it's going to crush is because a lot of the people who host these trade shows, like young people, are not getting into this industry, but they need to in order to usher in the next era. And I think there's a lot of opportunity to make money, and because I think it's going to actually grow significantly because people were so used to digital and they, I think, craved ways to connect physically. Now that these things have switched, Informa, I've been reading their earnings calls. They're doing a pretty good job of adapting to digital, but there's no platforms out there currently that do an adequate job of allowing vendors to have that transactional relationship at these events. But Zoom, here's the secret though with events: the content and the speakers, that shit doesn't matter. You only do that to attract the buyers and sellers. The real money is made in the relationship building of buyers and sellers, and Zoom does not adequately provide that environment.
Right. So unless there was a video app that allowed you to kind of go off into your own video with somebody. So like you go to someone's, let's say the virtual trade show is a bunch of Zooms. You click on something and you open up Zoom and now you're at somebody's trade booth. But it would be good to be able to go spin off into your own Zoom with a salesperson or whoever you're talking to and have your own conversation on the side. It's a little harder to do that in Zoom.
It's incredibly hard. It's incredibly hard, and there's no solutions that adequately do that. But I guess that's just another trend that I'm interested in, and things that I've been studying.
Yeah, I think my guess is, like, as much as I like Zoom, I do think it's a little bit of a right now what they're offering is a little bit of a commodity, which is just going to drastically improve in the new environment. So you're going to see, obviously, right now you see Facebook stepping in with their own competitor. We're using Squadcast now to do this podcast. So there's going to be a lot of improvements in kind of video conferencing technology over the next year, I think.
I agree. Man, people are sleeping on Facebook. That's one of the few stocks that I just hold and always buy more of. Facebook's portal is freaking awesome. Messenger.com. Do you ever use Messenger.com?
No.
Go to Messenger.com right now. That's owned by Facebook. That is Facebook. It's the best.
That's the Facebook Messenger?
Yeah, it's so good. A lot of people have no idea that it exists. I keep that open all day, and that's how I communicate to a lot of people. I use it as Slack almost. It's awesome.
Oh, yeah.
It's really cool.
Oh, but it is like, it's basically if I go to my all my, it's as if I click all my messages on Facebook on the desktop.
Yeah. And so the joke amongst my family and friends is if they want to talk to me, they have to use Facebook. I don't really text. I only Facebook.
Let me ask you a question. Like, I get messages now. This is what's really confusing to me. For 30 years, I'm an email guy, but now I get messages on email, text, Facebook, WhatsApp, Instagram, TikTok, LinkedIn.
Yeah, it sucks.
Probably other platforms. Is there any kind of mega mail application out there?
No, it sucks. I mean, look. Text message, Facebook Messenger, Facebook, Superhuman, phone call. No, there's so many freaking messages. I hate it. I don't know if there's a mega thing. I don't want that mega thing, though. If that.
Why? Because I miss messages all the time.
Yeah, I don't. I'd rather. That's not the solution to my problem. The solution to my problem is just don't talk to me. It's not. I don't want a way to talk to people. I don't want a way to easier. I don't want to talk to people in an easier way. I just want no one to talk to me.
And so you don't care if somebody sent you a message on WhatsApp and you missed it for 6 months.
I don't give a fuck. Yeah. I just delete.
Oh, well, I'm the same way because just by default because I only really look at my email. I don't, and then suddenly I'll remember like 2 months later. Oh, you know, I also get messages on Instagram, and I'll have all these messages like, why aren't you responding?
Yeah, I just and fuck them, like it. Yeah, I look like an asshole, but I just don't care. People are always talking about Inbox Zero and how much it stresses them. It's so easy. You just do select all and delete.
Yeah, I haven't done that because most of my emails are left unread. So I have over 300,000 unread emails.
Oh my God, it gives me a nightmare.
But then I use it as a database. Like I'll say, oh, who is this guy? And I'm able to see back through 10 years of email or 15 years of email. Oh, I got a message once before, or there was somebody mentioned him once before. So it's a good database for me but
I just delete it all.
You have a better memory than me though. So I have a hard time remembering everybody.
Yeah, no, I just delete them all. My philosophy is if it's important, they'll email me two or three times.
And so as we start to look at the light at the end of this tunnel, what do you see kind of the first, even though it's hard to predict again, what are the first steps you think are going to happen on the economy? And what are you seeing in terms of both entrepreneurs and more stable businesses? What are people thinking?
Well, in terms of the economy, I stay away from that because I'm just too simple-minded. I don't understand that stuff.
Yeah, so not the economy, but the economy is these businesses that we're talking about. Like, that's the economy, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's my belief, and a lot of people don't like hearing this, but wherever there's tragedy and bad stuff, there's gold and opportunity. So I think that for the right-minded person, there's just so much opportunity to pounce on right now. I think that I always call them B and C cities, which are actually the cities I prefer, like the Nashvilles of the world, the Austin, Texases of the world. They're going to just thrive. And we were talking about it. So I think like the first step is I think that like hundreds of thousands of people in San Francisco and New York are just going to be like, I'm out, and they're going to leave.
Yeah. I agree with that.
That's going to happen a lot. That's going to happen. I think it will happen. Probably more, I don't know, will it happen more in New York than San Francisco? San Francisco only has 10% of the people that New York has, but
yeah, let's compare notes. Like the last four people I've spoken to have all told me they're going to move out of New York.
Yeah, I was going to say like New York has like a buzz that you can't get anywhere that people like. San Francisco doesn't have that buzz necessarily, but it has, I think, a higher density of people specifically interested in technology. But New York doesn't have as much of a homeless problem and doesn't have as much of as a crime problem, but both are incredibly high taxed. So I think a lot of people are going to leave both those places.
And so how do you benefit? What does that make you think? Well, probably real estate in these B and C cities.
Yeah. I mean, real estate. I think I have two offices, one in Austin, Texas, and one in San Francisco. Most of our employees I'm canceling my lease in San Francisco. So my landlord, if you're listening, you're going to be out $15,000 a month. I mean, we're not renewing. So if you're a commercial real estate owner in San Francisco, I think you should be flipping out a little bit.
So potentially real estate in these other places. But I actually think those markets really will never suffer on real estate. Like it's not like, Like, I do think New York City prices are going to go down 20% to
30%. Absolutely, they're going to suffer. They're absolutely going to suffer. Why are you going to... You're rich, so you're different. But if you're a 21-year-old, why are you going to move to New York or San Francisco out of college and rent
No, I agree. New York City and San Francisco, I think 30% at least fall in real estate prices. But Nashville is what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah.
Or Austin.
Miami. Those places are so cheap comparatively. You know, it's kind of funny. I lived in Nashville for 5 years. I stay in Austin a lot because we have our main office at this point is there. They all complain. They go, oh, it's so expensive. Traffic's so bad. It's so not. It's so not bad. There's a lot of room. It's going to go up a lot.
What do you think of, you know, right now during this time, I think a lot of people have doubled down on content creation. So you see.
Yeah, it's going through the roof.
TikTok just announced they reached the 2 billion downloads of their app. You know, there's probably more, even companies like Netflix and YouTube have announced that they've reduced the quality of their videos by 25% because the internet was just breaking with all the bandwidth requests.
Yeah.
And so what do you see with like something like TikTok? Any opportunities there?
Well, let's just say the broader scale, like a lot of people don't realize this, but do you know what Gumroad is?
Yeah. It's like a book e-commerce site.
No, I would dumb it down even simpler, which is if you have a PDF or a digital file that you want to sell, Gumroad makes it really easy to create a very ugly but simple and effective landing page, and someone can just give you $10 for a PDF. So a lot of people sell workouts on there, or fiction or nonfiction short novels or guides on how to make something. But anyway, I know the guy Sahil, not well, but I know him, and he's the founder of it, and he is just crushing it right now. I mean, so many new creators are logging on to Gumroad to create content, and so many new buyers are coming. Same with Teachable. I think you know Encore from Teachable.
Yeah, I am/was an investor in Teachable, and they just sold, although I don't think the deal's closed yet.
Yeah, well, it sounded like it was a good exit. I think the rumor was...
Yes, $256 million, and I'll tell you, that is a high multiple of revenues for them.
It is a high multiple in revenues, but over the last 30 and 60 days, I think they've seen a huge surge in buyers and sellers of content. I know that with my company, Trends, which is people pay $300 a year for it, it's booming. I know people at Agora, and they're telling me the same thing. It's booming. I know people at Motley Fool, and people pay for stock advice. It's booming. So yeah, paid content right now, like paid newsletters, because I know I'm in that industry. Business is booming right now. Is it for what?
Yeah, I think
do you ever talk about Agora on here?
Not really, no.
Allowed to?
I do think, I mean, I do think the online newsletter business / online course business is in some ways the fastest. You know, you have that podcast, My First Million. I think selling a digital product is probably the fastest way to make a million. You know, and again, let's just assume, you know, sincerity, authenticity, honesty. You're creating something that you value, because again, sometimes the copywriting, particularly on the Agora side, sometimes the copywriting is very aggressive and sort of feels a little spammy. But let's just focusing on the content. If you make really honest, sincere, authentic content, and you're delivering a message you believe in, I think that's the fastest way to, like, when I started my company in 2015 to sell newsletters, you know, 99% of my content was free. I was writing every day. I was podcasting for free. I was writing for free on every platform. And so I kept 99% of my content free. But once a month, I would have a newsletter with business opportunities and some stocks and so on. And our first month in business, we generated $1.5 million in revenues.
Yeah.
And we were instantly $1 million profitable.
Yeah, it's crazy, right? It's people are shocked by this. I think Agora is a crazy company. You don't have to talk about them. I don't, because I think you sold to them. I don't know what you want
to
say.
No, I'm happy.
But
yeah,
I'll talk about them. Which is, I have heard that they do roughly $1 billion and close to a billion, in the ballpark of $1 billion in revenue, and it's mostly paid newsletters. And people are shocked when they hear that.
Oh yeah, Agora has more subscribers across their newsletters than any other media company in the world. So you could think, oh, well, what about the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times?
No.
You could combine them and 10 other newspapers and you won't even touch Agora. And by the way, Agora's business model is very interesting. There's kind of Agora, But then there's, let's say 20, I don't even know the full tree.
Yeah, they own like 30 brands, right?
Yeah, but they own like, let's say, a majority interest in all these other brands. But those are all independent companies. So if those if any of those companies go bankrupt, none of the liabilities go up to Agora Central. But every year, Agora just does a sweep on the percentage they take from each company. And it's probably like a billion. Overall gross is over a billion. And then Agora themselves probably makes between 500 million and a billion when they sweep in their take. And they don't, other than the initial setting up of a new business, they don't really have that many costs.
Yeah, I think it's actually probably one of the most, I would imagine it's one of the top 100 most profitable privately held companies in America, or close.
Yeah, and then each company that they own does the same model. So it all, and where they create other brands, and then, but they don't have any liabilities from those brands, and then they just do a sweep at the end of the year of all the profits.
Yeah, most people, like if you were just to tell someone who doesn't know it, who knows about business but not about that company, they'd be like, "What? That doesn't make sense." Like when we started our company, I knew about Agora, and I told the founder of one of the largest media companies in New York about it. Or I told him about my plans, and he goes, "This is so dumb. This business that you're starting, it's never going to make more. It probably won't ever. You won't cross $2 million a year in revenue." And we did a lot more than that, many, 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 many times more than that. And so people who are smart, and I tell them these ideas, and I use Agora as proof, which our company isn't like Agora, but the business model is definitely similar. But anyway, they're shocked when they hear these numbers.
Yeah, and you know, every aspect of the business, the basic business model of an Agora style business is that you have there's somebody who's the creator, who's the main creator of that particular brand or sub brand or whatever. And again, most of the content is free. In fact, the most valuable content is probably free. Just like the Hustle email you have is free. And that, for all we know, that's the most valuable thing in terms of the content that I consume or can consume from you. That might be the most valuable thing, is what you offer for free. But then...
Yes, but the majority of the revenue is going to be on the back end.
Yeah, so then there's a front end and a back end. So for instance, I have a newsletter where it's more... Which is my favorite part of it, actually, is a front end is kind of a lifestyle, entrepreneurial type newsletter. And that's... It's a subscription, but it's fairly cheap. And then there's back ends.
How much does that cost?
It varies. So that's the other great thing about a digital product, is that you can experiment almost every day with a different price. But let's just say $50 a year. So like almost nothing. But it kind of, that tells you who your favorite customers are. And then you market the back ends to those customers. And again, you have to make sure, I always make sure every piece of content is, sincere and has my best ideas and so on. But then, that's when you sell like an investment newsletter. And I hired analysts from Wall Street and, for every category that I sell, and you start selling more expensive newsletters. And that's really it. It's a very simple business model. There's nothing else. It's like, I don't sell merchandise. We don't really sell conferences or anything like that. It's just, a free newsletter, a front end and a back end. And then you might have multiple back ends. And then you do also some affiliate deals on the free.
Yeah, it's a newsletters are a wonderfully simple business model that it just shocks people how big they are.
Yeah, our third year in business, we did 60 million or maybe more, 70 or 80 million in revenues, and that doesn't even count gross, which was when you have affiliate deals with somebody, the full revenues of your product is much higher than the actual.
You guys did 70 million?
Yeah.
What were you selling?
Lots of things. I had like 10 backends. I had,
who was writing them? I mean, how big was your team?
Maybe like a dozen people.
Were the backends evergreen, or were they new stuff all the, like, was it new content that was be creating on a weekly basis?
New content. And we would be sometimes several times weekly.
And then, so then you just had like 10 different monthly newsletters.
Yeah. And the biggest one back then was, and I got kind of, almost ostracized for this. There's a lot of anguish for me.
But the Bitcoin one?
Yeah, the Bitcoin one. And again, you know, all of the content was, and my perspective on Bitcoin was fully mine. I'm still a believer in Bitcoin. My big issue was I saw a lot of my readers were getting scammed by a lot of these altcoins. And so I wanted to create a newsletter that would help them distinguish between legit currencies and these, you know, crappy altcoins that I even said in the very first one, 80% or 90% of these are going to go, 90% of these shit coins are going to go out of business or more. And I think right now it's about 80% of the coins that existed then are now out of business. And so the newsletter itself was, you know, highest quality, but the ads, because you're competing against thousands of other Bitcoin related newsletters, you have to get people's attention in the same way that all of those newsletters are getting people's attention. And so the ads were a bit, I would say, extreme, but that's the only way. If I tried to write my own ad, and I'm not a copywriter, I'm a writer, which is, as you know, is different than a copywriter. My versions of those ads would sell 1/100th the amount as an Agora style ad. So I just said, okay, I believe in my message. If this is the way to get the word out, so be it. But then the ads themselves would just, people would write articles about
the ad.
I would beg people, like even friends, I would beg people, just read the content. You'll like it. You'll see. We're on the same side. And they're like, I'm not reading it.
Well, so what was the average price of your back end?
For you know, it could be anywhere from 1,000 to 3,000.
And for $1,000, you get like a newsletter a month or a week?
At least once a week, at least. Sometimes twice a week or three times.
And it was
a week.
Just one analyst just banging out ideas.
Yeah, and me. So I would work with each newsletter.
That's a shit ton of work.
It was a lot of work, but you know, it's only a dozen people with, you know, a lot of revenues. But you know, then Agora, some of that profit goes up to them and you're paying for their services. They made all the ads. So it's like I'm paying for them to do the ads. So you know, it's complicated how it all works, but I don't know if I would do it the exact same way if I were to do it again. But it's definitely a model that works.
What would you have done? Owned the whole thing?
Yeah, maybe I would have owned the whole thing, because then there's I wouldn't have sold as much, because they're really geniuses at making the ads. And I really like working with them, actually. Like, they were all nice people. They were all dedicated to their jobs. But I do think, though, on that newsletter in particular, particularly after I'd been giving away all 100% of my content for free for 15 years, at that point, I think people were just in a little shock that I was, you know, I was also spending an enormous amount of money on ads. And so, and the ads were over the top. Like, I didn't like the ads. I always told them I didn't like the ads, but they were correct also in that, you know, Alain de Botton, who's this French philosopher, he says, if you want to compete with Machiavellian, if you're a good guy competing with bad guys, you still have to use their Machiavellian techniques to get audience, to get people's eyeballs to look at you. And, you know, unfortunately, I think the ads were over the top and it hurt me, but, you know, that was a long time ago. And people see that now the people who actually get the newsletter are really grateful. So I'm not sweating it that much. But back then in 2017, there would just be people crapping on me all the time, like all night long on Twitter. One time I shouldn't have gotten agitated at all, but one time at like 1 a.m, my girlfriend at the time was in the other room, and I'm just like looking at all these hate tweets about me. And I tweeted my phone number and I said, if anyone has a problem with me, can call me right now. And so from 1 a.m. to like 10 a.m. on a Saturday night, / Sunday morning, I just got nonstop phone calls, and I would pick each one up and talk to people.
I do that shit all the time. I always engage with trolls, and I always want to cross the barrier of internet to real life. I like, a lot of times I'm like, here's my address, have a discussion, come on.
Yeah, and well, what would happen is every person I would talk to, I would say, look, my goal is I'm trying to make Bitcoin more accessible to the layman. No, it's hard for people to figure out what Bitcoin is even now, and this was 3 years ago, where it was much more difficult. So that was what my newsletter was about, was explaining why this is a good service, and that will lead you to strategies of what coins are scams and what coins aren't. And so after I would speak to each person, and sometimes I was speaking to pretty high up people, like people who were created their own coins that are still very popular right now. And they would always then go back on Twitter and say, oh, I just spoke to James. It's actually different than I thought. He's all good. It's just the ads.
That's awesome.
And it's true. I still, you know, I don't know how if I regret completely the ads, because they did get me, you know, it did get the message out. And so sometimes you have to do those tactics. If I just said, please buy my newsletter, I'm a good guy, nobody would have even looked at me.
Yeah, totally.
But it is what it is. You know, so that's why I like your approach though a lot, which is build up a really, you know, valuable free newsletter, which I had, and I probably could have just stuck with that and had a good business without, you know, working with anybody else. But I did what I did and I don't regret it. But I think your model is very powerful with the hustle.
Yes, I agree. And it's a good model because I've stolen all of the best practices from people like you and a dozen other people.
Well, what best practices have you stolen?
Well, first of all, the whole idea of a newsletter, I mean, I stole that from The Daily Candy, which was a company that sold for $125 million.
Yeah, I remember that.
I looked at Daily Candy, I looked at Thrillist, and then I looked at Wall Street Journal and how they used to do things. And then I studied Agora. I studied a Japanese company that I love called Usabase. And I...
Usabase? What's it called?
Yeah, it's a publicly traded company called Usabase. It's spelled Uzabase. Before the corona happened, it was publicly traded at $850 million in revenue. $850 million market cap, about $150 million in recurring revenue. They offer two main products. One is called Speeda, which is a $13,000 a year database, and the other one is a news app that costs $100 a year. They're the company that bought Quartz for about $80 million 2 years ago. So I like Usabase. The way that the Japanese do stuff, I love it, and so I'm very fascinated with Japan. And so I like those guys. I like Motley Fool. Motley Fool interested me. They, I believe, the Gartner brothers and employees own the whole company at this point. And so I looked, when I started my business, I looked at very capital efficient companies, and they were one of them. Copywriting. I learned a shit ton about copywriting. I've read a bunch of Agora books on copywriting.
Agora runs a whole copywriting school, AWAI.
Yep. So I know all about
their copywriters. If you want to make a lot of money and you're listening to this, copywriting is the most important skill to have.
I tell people that all the time. They go, what should I do? I go, learn how to be a copywriter. And they go, well, I don't want to do that. I'm like, you don't understand. Copywriting is not about writing. Copywriting is about understanding how people think and selling them. You're going to sell an employee if you want them to join your company. You're going to sell a banker if you want a loan. You're going to sell your wife if you want to convince her to go out on a date with you. You have to convince people to do shit all the time. That's what copywriting is about.
And like, I'll tell you, when we have a product, let's say I had a product that sold $20 million worth, the copywriter gets 3%. And so let's say the copy, and he took like, let's say 2 months of writing to write all the copy for that. So, and maybe he's working on other projects as well. So the best copywriters I know are worth tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah.
Or more. Hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah. I mean, so from like a high level of just like the skill set of copywriting, it's pretty much just persuasion. But from a hard skill set perspective, it's like the easiest way to make money. But I'm a self-taught copywriter. So that's kind of what I come from. So copywriting is so important. So I looked at a lot of copywriters. And then the guy who changed my life was Ted Turner. I started CNN, so I stole a shit ton from what he did.
What's a couple things from there?
He went from advertising to actually owning a network, and so I use newspapers.com. That's one of my favorite websites, and I like to read old.
Write this down.
I pay $10 a month, and I like just last night I was doing it. So what I like to do is I'll look at where he was in his career and I'll reverse engineer it and I'll apply my learnings from what he has done. So for example, in 1978, he did a reverse merger. So Ted Turner, which eventually it became AOL and Time Warner and things like that. It started as Turner Advertising, and they built up a $20 million a year. In 1976, it was $20 million a year, which is the equivalent of like $40 million now. And so he had a $40 million a year billboard business, and he used those profits to buy a radio station in like 1977. And then he bought a local news network in 1978, and he would do things like, the news networks he bought were dog shit. They were really bad. CNN, people think of as legitimate now. It started as a joke. And he would do funny things. Like, he would put a bag over his head and have like the mysterious bad guy as the newscaster or the news anchor. And he would beg, like do phone-a-thons where he would like beg for money and saying how like, it's tough being number three in the market, but that just means we're going to work harder than everyone else. And so he would do all these marketing schemes that would try to push his, push his brand forward. And I find that shit to be incredibly interesting. And so I like look at some of those like tactics all the time. In terms of operating the company, I have stolen a ton from Ted Turner. So he was kind of a wild man who was a little bit manic, and he was not an operator, but he was pretty brilliant when it came to product creation and marketing. And I think I'm definitely similar to that. So I've hired a president of my company to kind of run the day-to-day. And that I stole that from Ted Turner.
I'll tell you, with Ted Turner, I love how he took a local Atlanta station, TBS, and he is the first person to take a local station. This was right after HBO started doing it on a national level, but HBO wasn't a local station. Turner did the same thing HBO did. He sent his signal to a tower, which, you know, then via satellite broadcast all over the country.
Yeah,
it's the first local station that actually broadcast all over the country.
I believe he had to fight the Supreme Court in order to do that. So he had a...
Oh, I didn't know that.
I think I'm not an expert on this particular part, but for some reason it was illegal to, like, it kind of like if you were the one who owned the satellite that would beam it and get access, there had to be some like barrier, like basically the way it worked was only a few people had access to the satellites that could beam it. And he was like, no, that's bullshit. We should all be able to do that. And he had it was originally against the law for him to do that. And so he had a fight to change the law. And so he's like, yeah. See, now I can have my own satellite. And so that he was the guy who made that possible.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. It's interesting because I sort of think local TV now should follow in a weird way his model, which is every local affiliate has an audience, but they're local, but they can all be mini Netflixes. So they can all transmit, you know, and make their own app and make it, you know, sell it through the Apple TV store or...
Yes, this is what I was talking about earlier. I think this type of shit, I think, is going to get more popular.
Yeah, I do as well. I think, you know, you can imagine exchanges where people post, upload television shows, even a few minutes or long form, short form. And then in each market, somebody, I'm actually invested in a company that does this.
Who?
Each market can kind of grab, it's called Syncback, SYNCBAK. SBTV.com is, they're still in alpha, but they're creating essentially an exchange for local in each market, the local stations.
It makes total sense. Shows. Do you have like a vacation home, or do you like go to any small towns?
No.
Okay. So are you from a small town?
No.
Okay. So you...
I'm born here.
So you maybe can't understand this, but maybe you can. But if I go to Grand Junction, Colorado, which is a town that has maybe 200,000 people, and like you think, like, Grand Junction, Colorado, who cares about Grand Junction, Colorado? It's small. It's not that big. It's not that big. Like, well, you know who cares about it, and they care about it a ton, is the people who live in Grand Junction, Colorado. And if I create a video series only about Grand Junction, Colorado, you better bet that like 40% of that 100,000 people are going to want to see that thing. And so that's the great stuff about, the great thing about local news is that the engagement is ultra high, because if I have a news program and all I do is talk about the local residents, likely everyone is going to either see themselves or the people they know on that show. And so the engagement is going to be through the roof, and you could charge money for that.
Yeah. Well, you know, Sam, I thank you for spending so much time. You've downloaded an enormous amount of knowledge on us here all these great ideas, great business models. I hope you come on again. Maybe after the shutdown's over, you come on again and tell us what you see is happening in terms of the trends and so on.
Yeah.
But I highly recommend the Hustle newsletter. Always so many ideas that make me think. While we were talking, I subscribed to Trends, so I'm going to check that out.
Oh, cool. Well, let's do... I'm going to write this down. We'll do a code for your listeners. So like we'll do like a 20% off thing. So if you type in, what code you want to do? Like James?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll do James. So if you type in the word James, you'll get a special discount. We'll make it a surprise what the discount is, but just use the code James.
Okay, trends.co/James or trends.co, and then there's just discount code James.
The second one. So just go to the normal website and you can just type. Your listeners are smart. They'll figure it out.
Excellent. And you should have me on your My First Million podcast. I have some fun stories.
We should do it. We record every Monday and Wednesday. So in the next 2 or 3 weeks, we'll get you on.
Yeah, excellent. All right, Sam Parr, founder of The Hustle, which I highly recommend. Thanks so much for giving us all this great knowledge, all these fantastic business models. And Sam, once again, Sam Parr, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.